Okay, you're used to humans using tools, and we now know that apes and even birds use them, a sign of cerebral sophistication. But invertebrates? This is remarkable. But Mark Norman from the Museum of Victoria is constantly revealing remarkable things about marine life. I've just seen an amazing film on your laptop about an octopus, which looks quite a large octopus running along the bottom of the ocean, using coconuts. Where did you find this?
We found this in Indonesia, in several places, in northern Sulawesi and in Bali. But this very cute octopus lives on soft mud and sand, and it's a pretty scary place for an octopus. And it's evolved this shell use, which is like carrying your own sort of supperware or dinnerware. And then if somebody comes along, you assemble them as a sphere and jump inside the two halves. So they're sort of carrying coconut shell halves as their own bowls, or we think it's tools, like designer shields that can be joined together and you can hide in the middle.
It's a very large coconut compared to the size of the octopus, I must say. Were you on the bottom of the ocean just filming away and you suddenly saw this?
We've seen this species many, many times in different places, but we're lucky enough to come across four individuals in different places that had obviously decided these shells were perfect shelter. And they carry them in this sort of stilt-walking form where they turn them concave up, so they're sort of the vulnerable side sticking up, and then they put eight arms over the sides, make them rigid and run on these stilts like some circus performer. And then if something comes along, they stop and pull them over their head and close them up and make the perfect armour. So it would have been bivalve shells like clams in an evolutionary sense, but they've found these discarded ones from Indonesian communities are perfect for mobile transport and shelter.
And you're convinced it's tool use?
Well, if you look at definitions of tool use, there's all this talk about how it's an object carried or maintained for some future use. And if we had an analogy where a chimpanzee picked up two leaves of certain sizes, carried them with them until the sun came out and then assembled them on their head to be shade, everybody would call it another form of tool use. But because it's an octopus and an invertebrate and a super snail, everybody goes, it's not possible that that's tool use. They're just simple little creatures.
But they're terribly bright. The reason I don't eat octopus is their IQ is the same as mine.
Yes, that's true. They are very, very bright. I think their brain is 90% vision, so they're very, very clever visually. I'm not sure they're very good on Rubik's Cubes because they don't see colour. It's all tonal, so they just make a mess of it. But they are spectacular and interesting creatures.
Do you think they learned how to do this quite recently?
No, I actually think it's a genetic memory or genetic intelligence that over the millions of years they've been in these environments, they've found that carrying big clamshells with them end up being a good defence. And the ones that were bad at it or didn't assemble them quick enough sort of got killed along the way. And these are the ones that refined it down to portable armour.
And I'd imagine that the coconuts are slightly lighter and easier to manage underwater than the clamshells.
Oh, I think they're perfect. I think when humans started eating them and throwing the shell halves away, the octopuses were delighted and started hoarding them.
Which brings me to preparing a cuttlefish meal by dolphins?
This is actually both papers. The senior author is Dr. Julian Finn, who's one of my ex-students at the museum, and he discovered this behaviour in the dolphins, where dolphins visiting the giant cuttlefish spawning grounds in South Australia have this really regular technique where they find a cuttlefish, they flush it out over the sand, they stand vertically in the water, the dolphin does, pushes down on the cuttlefish, and you can hear a click as it breaks between the cuttle bone and the cartilage of the brain. So it kills the cuttlefish. Then they lift the cuttlefish up mid-water and start smashing it with their snout until the ink sac ruptures, and you can see this explosion of ink come out. Then they take the cuttlefish down, turn it upside down, and run it along the sand like they're pushing a sled along. And this strips the thin skin that's on top of the cuttlefish, and the cuttle bone pops out intact. And so it's sort of this combination of six moves that makes perfect cuttlefish sushi and makes a really good quality feed for them, whereas if the ink was still in there that causes digestive problems, the cuttle bone would be like a mouthful of gravel if you were eating it yourself. And the combination means they just have pure meat. And when you see the dolphins moving through these cuttle grounds, you can often see individual cuttle bones bobbing to the surface where they've gone through. So they've been pigging out, doing the sushi chef, and then moving on to the next one. So it's really a wonderful evolution of that sort of system. And it's probably unique to that area because 100,000 giant cuttlefish gather at this one tiny site in Spencer Gulf. And the dolphins come and do the rounds for 3 months every year. So they've probably had tens of thousands of years of practice of how to make that meal just perfect when all these captive animals are sort of sitting there.
And they don't do it elsewhere in the world that you know of?
Not ever heard of. And for cuttlefish, it's very unusual to have even 20 getting together in a breeding aggregation, whereas at the peak before the fishing hit that little reef in Spencer Gulf, 250,000 cuttlefish were taken off 3 kilometres of reef in 3 months. So it's a huge, huge breeding aggregation, and it's still recovering from that. And it's still got issues in terms of developments they're proposing right on top of that rocky reef at the moment for a deep water port and a desalination plant. So it's not safe yet for the giant cuttlefish.
Amazing stuff. You're still finding, Mark, in the marine environment, completely astonishing things, aren't you?
It blows me away that even on our doorstep, like 2 kilometres from where we're sitting, there's phenomenal things going on every night. And so we did an honours project with a student of mine, Jasper Montana, who's now with the BBC, but he worked on a sand octopus that makes its own quicksand by blowing jets of water into the sand, dives into the liquidised sand, and then forms a mucus burrow underneath with a long chimney to the surface, all out of mucus in its arms. And if something comes and harasses it, it collapses the chimney and swims off through the sand to somewhere else. And these things are sort of right on our doorsteps, and almost every animal you look at turns out to have some amazing behaviour. So I think we've really not even scratched the surface on some of these animal groups and their behaviours.
Just wonderful. Is that why the museum has produced this guide to various creatures in the marine world?
We've started a series called the Museum Victoria Field Guides to Marine Life, and it starts with a book called An Introduction to Marine Life. And we're doing it for sort of 4 reasons. Firstly, everybody treats the sea as a black hole, and if they're not eating things out of it, they've got very little idea what goes on or even what lives there. So the first book covers every group that's in the sea, from bacteria to whales, so that you know that this funny gooey thing that's washed up on a beach is this sort of animal and is related to this and might have this behaviour. So it's sort of the starting point. And then over the next 5 years, we plan to do possibly 30 titles on individual groups. So we've finished crabs, we've finished barnacles, we've finished shrimps and lobsters. We're going to do sea spiders, bivalve shells, nudibranchs, the really colourful sea slugs, feather corals, lace corals, sponges. We're finishing one on sponges at the moment. And in about 12 months of diving, we're up to 105 species from southern Australian waters. And they're ranging from giant vase sponges to things that grow in slime over rocks and other ones that are living in symbiotic relationships with little swimming scallops and just fantastic stuff. So the author of that book, Lisa Gowdy, is doing all the taxonomy, and we've photographed everything live so that you've got the spectacular live photograph and then the information on what the animal is. And we're trying to let the public delve down into what's there, give them some tools to appreciate it, raise the profile. And there's 2 other things that are important. Document what's on our doorstep while it's still here. I mean, climate change can be totally devastating, both from ocean acidification, but also from the whole movement of tropical things pushing our unique things off the southern end of Australia. But also, we got the grant to start this series from the Old Natural Heritage Trust to capture the knowledge of experts. The expert for Australia for feather corals, the hydroids, is 82. And the expert for bivalve shells are in their 60s and 70s, or the experts on sea spiders are in their 60s. And if we don't capture this, the new generation is all vitamising things in molecular labs, which is fantastic, interesting insights. But the knowledge of the individual animals out in the wild and picking something up and going, I know what this is actually a dying breed. So the classical taxonomists are sort of disappearing. So for some of these books, we want to document the current state of knowledge of the 200 species of whatever, sea slugs in Victorian waters, and then, you know, make sure we've got that as a starting point and encourage the next generation of enthusiasts to see some value in understanding the diversity that's on our doorstep.
Yeah, but I must say that the books themselves are small, light, wonderfully illustrated. And you can actually take them down the beach, can't you? I mean,
and that was our aim.
Almost waterproof.
We got that sort of semi-plasticized paper at the start of the introduction book. We put in all these quick guides for gooey things on the beach, or things you might see when you're fishing, or things that might be dangerous, so that at a glance you can see 20 options that might nest you further into the book. And as we do each book, we're getting cleverer on how do I tell them apart, or why are these interesting? Like a book on barnacles, we thought, you know, this is going to have a limited appeal. And in the end, as we delved into it, you find out there's parasitic barnacles that get inside crabs and digest away the reproductive tracts and change the behaviour of the crab. And then when they're ready to mate, they just put this reproductive organ out of their paw, host and then just pump their young out into the sea. There's other ones like whale barnacles that have co-evolved with whales so much they can't live independent of the callosities on whales. And so at every level, Charles Darwin was a barnacle
nut.
There's
10 years
all that sort of stuff.
Oh, a whole decade.
Huge,
isn't it?
Huge amount of work. So as we get into each group, we go, even sponges, you know, there's fantastic things. There's some sponges you can push through a fly wire and they'll reassemble themselves on the other side like something out of Terminator. And you go, that's not boring. And every group we're working with, it's not boring.
Again.
So it's been a really good eye opener for us. And because
Indeed.
We're photographing it all live in the wild, it's been really exciting sort of getting more behaviour on lots of those animals.
You might
as well.
Not see an octopus with a coconut shell, but you can see vast numbers of things as well.
Yes. And, I mean, at Port Phillip Bay, every year, 10 to 50,000 spider crabs walk up our channels and get up into the shallows and molt in an area the size of a football field, 10 deep, and each one's about 40 centimetres across. And you get out in that and you lie on the bottom as the wave's coming towards you and you can hear the clicking like knitting needles as these things walk over the top of you and give you this sort of spiky massage and it goes dark from them growing over the top of you. Now, that's something that's right on our doorstep that 99.9% of Melbourne has no idea of. And I just think there's wonders at every level really close to shore.
You've talked about Victoria, but finally those books are available around the...
They're available around the country, and the aim in terms of the groups it covered is to cover the sort of southern half of Australia, Perth to Sydney, and it's not the Great Barrier Reef and not the tropical coral species, but we also feel that these are sort of the unsung heroes in the southern half of the country. So, you know, the sea dragons and those spider crab swarms and the kelp forests and all these wonderful systems. We just wanted to get those stories out there.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Mark Norman, Museum of Victoria. And look out for their series of books on marine life. And this is my favourite song about marine life, Where Corals Lie. Incomparable Janet Baker, The Land Where Corals Lie from Sea Pictures by Edward Elgar.